We are in Portland, Oregon, at the Oregon Convention Center. It's the 32nd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society. But importantly, as part of this meeting, it's a symposium today, later today, honoring 10 years of the David Rummelhart Prize in Cognitive Science. And the prize was initiated, and you're going to get the story. This is Robert Glushko, Bob Glushko, yeah, more generally known as, who 10 years ago came up with the idea with Jay McClelland, who we'll also be talking to. I want to get some sense of this, because you produced this nice little red book, The Outstanding Questions in Cognitive Science. You have the model, the medals for people and so on. But it's not just about the funding. You're actually a bona fide scientist. You got into this thing. You knew Rummelhart McClelland very early on.
Right.
But then you went on a different path into business and so on.
Right.
So I'd like to get some sense of how this all happened, how you see your role and trajectory.
Okay. I was a graduate student of Dave Rummelhart in the late 1970s at University of California, San Diego. My thesis committee included Jeff Ellman and Jay McClelland, who were two winners of the Rummelhart Prize. But I had probably more of an applied bent as a psychologist than many people that I wanted. I'm studying reading in my PhD thesis, and I wanted to get a job where I could make a difference in the world. And so I looked at a number of academic jobs and didn't get the one I wanted, and I was a little disappointed at first, but Dave Rummelhart said to me, and I never forget this, he said that what really matters is that you go someplace where people value what you do. And that liberated me. And I went off to Bell Labs into an applied research area, which was I had not even imagined it, you know, as a graduate student going to a place like Bell Labs, and got involved in electronic publishing and electronic documents, and sort of invented the electronic book kind of thing that people now do, which was a kind of an adjunct or evolution from my thinking about reading and text processing. And I did that for several years, and after Bell Labs broke up, I went off into private industry, and I became a consultant and started working on electronic books more generally and helping people become electronic publishers. Many of my clients turned out to be in Silicon Valley in the early 1990s. One of my clients talked me into starting a company with them. And I had a company that did electronic publishing. We were helping companies move from really piles of electronic, of physical paper to electronic documents, which at the time meant published CD-ROMs with lots of stuff on it. And that's a good problem in applied cognitive science. It's about how to carve up a body of knowledge into pieces that can be reused so that the same content can be published in paper, online, in Braille, different formats for different purposes. The same content can become a reference manual, a troubleshooting guide, a tutorial. So again, it's these interesting problems of information architecture and design that they're definitely cognitive science. But I stopped thinking of myself as a cognitive scientist. I thought of myself as someone who's out there working in the world, doing stuff that made a difference to companies and making business and stuff. That company turned out to blow up. You know, the web came along, and to me as a scientist, it's just another one of those outputs. You can take the same content and publish it for the web. Why not? But to the business world, it meant, great, we can fire all of our technical writers and have our engineers make web pages. And my company blew up horribly in the mid-1990s. And I said, well, what do I know how to do? And I said, well, you know, actually, I know how to think about information. I know how to think of information and design pieces that are reusable and things like that. So I took the sort of survivors of that company, in a sense, and we started another company that did some of the same things from an intellectual standpoint, like taking information and building libraries of pieces so you can reuse them. But we did the thing in the middle now. Instead of doing the catalogs and the technical manuals, which are sort of pre and post transaction, we did the transaction. And the company I was part of built what amounted to the first platform for doing business-to-business transactions. So we built the first kind of foundations for electronic commerce using on the internet. And the same questions about what kinds of pieces of information should you use so you can build transactional documents intelligently. Again, what is the intersection of all business transactions? There are parties, there are locations, there's time, there's measurement, there's items. So you build this kind of semantic building blocks that you can then reassemble in these different documents. And because you have them from the same vocabulary, like the same document DNA, you're able to reassemble in efficient ways the documents needed to carry out business. So you can do efficient business-to-business commerce because you have this new paradigm that says there's semantic building blocks. And that was something we pioneered at this company. So in the late 1990s, during the internet bubble, my little company got bought, and the company that bought us went public. And it was the summer of 1999. I remember this very well, because that was the time when we saw David Rumelhart seriously begin to deteriorate.
He had Pick syndrome,
which is this the irony, the sort of tragedy and the ironic tragedy that someone who was cognitive science essential could essentially lose cognitive function. That's just this sort of tragedy. And so Jay McClellan organized in the fall of 1999 a reunion of all of Rumelhart's students and collaborators and so on at Carnegie Mellon. And I went, and it was like Dave would see, well, I know you, but it was like so much of it was gone, it was just tragic to all of us. And so we talked that night at dinner saying we should have a scholarship or something. And I thought I could probably afford to contribute to a scholarship fund or something like that, because I was going to make some money in my company I could sell my stock and so on. And then internet bubble happened, and in the end of the year I'd made tens of millions of dollars, and boom, right? And so I remember picking the phone and calling up Jay McClellan and said, you know, I can do better than fund a scholarship. And I had this idea of some kind of scientific prize. I mean, so we need a Nobel Prize in cognitive science. And I said, no, I realize that gives Nobel too much credit. But I didn't want it to be the Gluskar Prize, because it wasn't about me, it was about Dave Rumelhart. And so Jay and I worked out how we would create this prize and how we would select the prize winners. And
yeah, actually, on this whole notion of prizes, I mean, this is interesting to me, not only because we're involved to some extent with the XPRIZE Foundation talking about the incentive that a prize brings to sort of finding a prize for education, for example. And Peter Diamandis always says you get what you incentivize.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm very interested in this notion of the prize in terms of cognitive science, because these the pretty stellar group of winners here. Are you a great believer in prizes? I mean, I suppose you must be.
I'm not sure. I'm a prizeaholic. I mean, it wasn't about the prize per se. It was about the fact that I didn't want people to remember Dave Rumelhart as this poor guy that died prematurely or that was no longer a scientist. And I mean, I want people to remember the Dave Rumelhart, who was this brilliant scientist, who was a generous man, personally and professionally. He gave away thousands of. He could have been the first or second author on thousands of papers he doesn't even appear on, because he just gave away ideas. He cared about the science, and I wanted to remember Dave Rumelhart that way, by giving an award to people who exemplified both great science and great values. All right, so people who win this prize are people who are great scientists, but they also are thought of as great mentors. They have devoted students, loyal kind of, you know, acolytes who carry on their work because they inspired them and things like that. And they're not people who put the name on every paper that goes near their lab. Right, so we all know people who have thousands of publications because someone who walks by the hallway and gets a little bit of funding, that makes that funder the second author of the paper. And that's Dave is so not like that, and people who win the prize are so not like that. They're generous people. They care about the science. And that's what we wanted to remember with the Rumelhart Prize, good science and good people.
So your own entry into this whole field, I ask everybody this as well. I mean, there's often a stimulus that gets people interested in science. Either they see in school, there's a special teacher, or there's a
parent.
There's
a nice connection there, too.
What's
my undergraduate advisor at Stanford was Roger Shepard.
Who I'll be talking
to. And you'll be talking to him in a little bit. Roger Shepard was, again, he's a brilliant guy, and I took a course from him on the psychology of perceptual experience. And I was sort of undetermined engineering undergraduate. And I took this course, and it was just inspiring that Roger talked about how people, he showed photographs from the history of art and, you know, illusions and, you know, how the mind does these strange things with perception and memory. And it just was an inspiring class. And so we had a choice of doing a midterm and a final or doing a project. So I did a project. I did a little experiment instead of doing the final midterm. And Roger liked my experiment and said, you should take my graduate course next semester. And so I was this undergraduate in this graduate course seminar at Stanford with Roger Shepard as my teacher. And I was just, a year later, he was sending me off to graduate school to go to UC San Diego to.
So that was actually a total course shift.
Yeah, Roger sort of made me into a cognitive psychologist.
So In terms of the importance of science, again, I want to go through some questions that I've been asking all of the rest of them as well. From your perspective as somebody who started with a scientific career and then transmuted it into a business career at the same time. As the new administration took over, President Obama in his inaugural address said that they would restore science to its rightful place. And I'd like to get some sense from you of what you think the rightful place of science is.
I think the problem we have in this country is that we have too much of a black and white definition about science. You know, there's like real science and then there's everything else. Right? And in my own career, I look and I see how I have moved rather fluidly between big science with a capital S and sort of small science and applied science and, you know, build companies that use a lot of science kind of thing. And now I've come back. In fact, I left Silicon Valley and I went to Berkeley as an adjunct professor. And I find myself doing science again, reflecting on my years in business and how I wrote a book about the design of the semantics of business systems. I call it document engineering, right? So again, it's I think that science, to be restored to rightful place, should be science is sort of a continuum, right? And kind of the glorification of sort of hard science or big S, capital S science at the expense of sort of scientific thinking and sort of more rigorous, you know, seeing the intellectual content of what you're doing is science, okay? And I think that's what I hope we're talking about. I don't think we are, but that's what I would like to be talking about. Because I know in my own life, I've tried very hard to teach students now, saying that you want to find the abstractions, the ones that are generative, the ones that really help you understand new things, not just the stuff you're working on now. That's science, right? And so having a perspective that says, I can take what I'm learning here, but do it in a way which lets me apply it to new domains I haven't anticipated, new problems I haven't anticipated. That kind of more reflective, abstract, generative thinking is what science is about, finding new ways of thinking about problems. And we too often think that science is, well, you got to be in the laboratory with your white coat and everything else is a science, and that's just not the way you should think about it. So, you know, I worry that we have a naive view of science because we have a naive view of, you know, our legislators are not scientists, they're lawyers and other things, but so they don't see science in the way that scientists see it. So all the pronouncements about science from coming out of Washington won't matter unless the scientists can drive some of this agenda rather than the politicians.
This meeting, 10 years of Rummelhart Symposia, yeah. I mean prizes, next year, the 25th anniversary of the McClellan Rummelhart volumes on parallel distributed processing. Do you, from having been in there and now sitting back watching the field evolve, did you see that as being a revolution going on there? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, I was doing a PhD dissertation in that kind of, I mean, Rummelhart was my advisor, McClellan was on my committee, Elmo was on my committee. We were really starting to think of language and learning and things in different ways. You could tell it was, you know, we talked about interactive parallel models of cognitive phenomenon. And they hadn't worked out the kind of mathematics around neural nets yet, but we were talking about their multiple levels of knowledge. And I mean, my thesis is about how you read things you've never seen before. You know, when you see a word like TAVE, you say, well, that's TAVE, right? But how do you do that, right? Well, do you do it because it looks like cave or because you know that E makes vowels, you know, long and or that you remember, you know, other kind of things. And so you're using multiple levels of knowledge to do that. And, you know, we were saying, well, how do we combine these multiple levels of knowledge? Now, we hadn't figured out yet that could do this. But in fact, 10 years later, McClellan took my thesis data and did a connectionist model of it, right? So we were all getting it to happen. It's just that, and you can see something really big was happening, like this shift between the kind of serial, you know, almost comic book computer notion of serial processor, you know, things come in, they get processed, then come out, to much more complicated notions of cognitive computation that had to deal with the fact there were multiple levels of knowledge and that it wasn't really clear what knowledge was and what processing was because it was getting kind of mangled in there somehow. And that I remember saying that it looked like reading was like kind of a horse race and whichever bit of knowledge won first would come up with the answer. Right. And so there's kind of a, you know, that's not a very articulate way of talking about a connectionist model, but for me, it was like, how can you figure out how these different levels of knowledge kind of all, somehow they fight, and then something comes out in the synthesis of all those different things.
But that debate still goes on. I mean, I mentioned to the other folks that articles in press, in TICS, Trends in Cognitive Science right now, there's a position paper by Jay and other folks, Jay McClelland. There's a response from a letter from Alison Gopnik and Andy Meltzoff, Henry Wellman, so on. Another piece talking about the Bayesian brain aspect from Josh Tenenbaum and another group. Jerry Feldman in there saying, got to stop having these different groups pounding against each other. It's about integration and so on. So it's still obviously lively debate here.
Points of view. We only have one brain and one mind. We have different points of view on. I think part of it is that I have the luxury of being, I mean, I jokingly sound Rip Van Winkle of cognitive science, because I was a cognitive scientist. I went off and did other things for 10 or 15 years, and I came back. And now my view of cognitive science is pretty skewed, because I read the stuff that Rummelhart Prize winners and nominees do. So I have a view of the sort of the really cutting edge, deep things going on in cognitive science. And I can look at it a little more detached, because I'm not in that battle, but I'm watching it very closely at the trenches. And it's, again, If we had it figured out, it wouldn't be fun anymore, right? So I think there's still this, and sometimes at a level, the same issues about different kinds of sources of knowledge are fighting it out, and there's going to be a synthesis. So at the level of how reading happens and letter, how cognitive science happens, it's the same problem, just a different level of scale.
Because of this interesting trajectory, I'm intrigued to know what you would say with 1,000 people out there, many of them young scientists, which is a great sign. From your perspective now, what would your advice be to a young scientist?
I said, don't be afraid to not do big S science. Right? I mean, when Dave Rumhart said to me, it's okay to go to Bell Labs and be an applied researcher rather than going to a university, because they seem to think more highly of your work than the people that you were interviewing in the universities were. So you should find ways to collaborate across, not just disciplinary boundaries, but across sort of, you might say, that business or scientific continuum boundary. So you should be finding people to work with in real companies. Find practical questions. One thing that I've been driving very hard in this field, I actually was part of a symposium, we wrote a paper a couple years ago in TICS called Categorization in the Wild, in which we argued that cognitive science was still stuck too narrowly on studying concepts and categorization in like how the language does it, and they would study it in the laboratory. And I'm saying we have categorization at internet scale taking place. We have Flickr with 1 billion photos out there. We should be studying how people tag pictures in Flickr, and how they tag resources with Delicious and other internet kind of things. How people use Yelp and other kinds of things where they're tagging billions of objects. They're assigning things to categories. Is that a better way to study cognitive science of categorization than in your laboratory?
This is a takeoff on Ed Hutchins' phrase, of course, isn't it? Cognition in the wild,
right?
That's right.
So, that's exactly what it is.
But the wild now, you're saying, is...
It's internet scale.
Yeah.
When you have 1 billion photos in Flickr, I mean, and you go to a laboratory at the University of Texas with a couple of undergraduates and you study for 30 minutes, people assigning labels to pictures.
Well, so
somehow you have to argue that that's relevant. Well, the internet is where it's already happening. That's where it should be being studied.
But how do you view that? I mean, we're sitting here with iPads and so on and so forth, all wired and connected in and so on. But there's also the people who say about Twitter, the Twitterverse, you know, humph. It's all debasing human language, but
Twitter, and I have students who work at Twitter, right? Because so Twitter's an interesting laboratory, because Twitter, you have this interesting problem of how a 140 character limitation that Twitter has because of the implementation technology with text messaging, how has that required people to innovate in the use of language? They now have to invent hashtags that follow grammars. People invent tags to associate semantics with Twitter streams. Like I could say, you could tag a tweet from this conference as Cogside 2010, Cogside 2010. And then you could find people's reaction to this conference. People invent those kinds of new tagging semiotics, right? You could look at Flickr. Flickr is a wonderful laboratory for that, because it has one string limitation. You kind of tag to pictures. If you look for the word red, you can find a million pictures on Flickr that are tagged red. If you look for the string red, one string, With no space, you'll find 1,000 very red pictures. People have invented this convention to overcome this limitation of the implementation of Flickr. That's fascinating. That is categorization in the wild. We're using watching language evolve at internet scale.
I got two other quick questions. Yeah. I know we're a bit compressed here. I know you didn't even want to do this, but I actually wanted to get some information from you because this is really interesting. A question I like to give people just to get some sense of how you think is, if I gave you a time travel token and said you can bring anybody from any time period, artist, scientist, whomever, to your dinner table, ask them some questions. Anybody that you'd really like to sort of have a conversation with?
Dave Rummelhart. Maybe you've heard that from everybody, but
Dave Rummelhart said it. Actually, it's interesting.
Dave Rummelhart.
What do you think? All right, so let me convert this slightly. What do you think he would make of this current state of things, the internet, and all this sort of stuff? And
I think Dave would say, "Isn't it great? We have a whole new laboratory to play in. You know, we can get a phenomenon that we never could get at before." When I was a graduate student trying to figure out, we tried to do studies of word recognition. There was the corpus that everyone used was called the Cacheron-Francis corpus, the Brown corpus. It had a million words in it. A million words is a staggering amount of content to work on to help develop stimuli. What words exist in the language that have following properties so you can design careful stimulus sets? It had a million words. Dave got this corpus from Brown and wrote software so we could do quick searches and find stimulus. He enabled us to do better research by writing software on this database of words. Now we have trillions of words. We can do better design of stimuli. Dave would say, "Isn't it great?" But I knew I was going to get there because I was doing it in 1977 with the Cacheron-Francis tapes. Right? So, I mean, Dave was someone who, I want to say, never met a problem he didn't like. Okay? Because he could always look at something and said, "There's nothing really interesting here." Okay? And he also said something which I know I'm guilty of sin as hell of, which is that he never heard a talk he didn't like. Someone would give a talk, and you know, a lot of us say, "Oh, that was a terrible talk, that bad science." They would say, every time you hear a talk, you could learn something from that talk, right? Because even if you learn, that's not a very productive way to think of this problem. You learn that. So Dave would be, I mean, he'd be the statesman of this field, because he'd be out there saying, "There's still new stuff to do here, you know? I've been doing it for 30 years, and I've got still new problems that I want to study every single day."
It's very interesting. Isaac Asimov used to say, when somebody asked him what characterized science, he would say, "Well, it's not, you know, it's not eureka. It's you see something, you go, that's interesting." I mean, it's the quest.
That is Dave Rummelhart. I mean, if you have a picture of the medal sometime that we made, the medallion for Dave Rummelhart, yeah. You see that there's Dave in a fairly informal pose with his hand on his chin, because that's the Dave Rummelhart most of us remember. A Dave who you would go to and want to talk to, and who seemed to always have time for you as a student or as a colleague, and you'd say, "Dave, I got this problem." And he'd look at you and he'd put his hand on his chin and look back and, you know, sort of play with his beard a little bit, and look out the window, and you're thinking, you know, "Are you still with me?" And he would take minutes sometimes and just sort of be just deep in thought, and he turned to you and said, "You should do this." And he was, you know, it'd be like your next 3 months of work kind of thing, right? Because he really thought about stuff, okay? And it was, he always acted like your problem was important. And even when he said, "I don't know what the answer is," it might be that 2 days later he'll be giving a talk and your stuff would kind of be mingled into it. There's this interesting twist that, you know, that Bob mentioned, or that Jay mentioned, or that Jeff and we would be like, he would have had assimilated it into sort of his evolving thing, because he had no boundaries. He didn't say, "This is the word recognition problem, this is the language problem, this is the story grammar problem." This, like, this is a problem, and it all has to fit together.
And that's a nice indication of what's going on in the discipline as well, the way it's becoming so interdisciplinary. I have one last question for you, which I ask everybody, and I have to talk to Roger Shepherd. What are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic that this field is going to deserve Dave Rummelhart. I mean, again, there was when we started this prize 10 years ago, I mean, the conference was much smaller. There had been a lot of splintering, a lot of groups that spun off from cognitive science at their own little separate conferences. And this conference had 200 people coming to it. And that's because the sort of intellectual focus of cognitive science wasn't here. I mean, it was other more narrowly defined conferences. professors weren't coming here as much. Mostly students were coming to cognitive science. It was kind of the graduate student conference. And now you have a conference which has been revitalized. It's like where the action is. And because like today we have, you know, 9 cognitive Rummelhart Prize winners here. You know, this is the sort of, you know, people coming back and their cadres are coming back. And there seems to be a lot more of this kind of enthusiasm, intellectual enthusiasm about cognitive science in this place. The fact the conference is now nearly 1,000 people is because this is the place to be now in cognitive science. So, I think to a certain extent, Rummelhart Prize takes credit for that, that we have really helped provide a focus for this conference as a place where these, you know, deep, distinguished cognitive science can give talks, and they have the plenary symposia. And, you know, the announcement of the next winner is always kind of an exciting moment in the conference. And so it's become a place where people want to be.
I should try and find the next. It's Judea Perlman, right?
So Judea Perlman.
That's been announced. Yeah. But in the interim, till I talk to him and a few other things, Bob, nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.